A dealer tells you the truck has never been in an accident. You buy it, relying on that. Months later, you learn the frame was welded back together after a crash. Here is the part that decides a lot of these cases. A history report would have shown that crash in a minute, and you never pulled one. Does that sink your claim? No. A fraud victim generally has no duty to investigate. You are entitled to take an affirmative factual assertion at face value, and a liar cannot hide behind your failure to double-check. Today, the tort of being lied to and losing money over it. Two flavors, and they differ almost entirely in the defendant's state of mind. Here is the root. First, fraud. All six elements one at a time, because the claim dies the moment any one is missing. Then, negligent misrepresentation. The careless information tort, which is easier to prove and far harder to sue on. Then the side-by-side comparison the exam rewards. And finally, the defenses, including the as-is clause sellers love. Start with what this tort protects. Most torts protect your body or your property. Misrepresentation protects your wallet in a deal. The harm is purely financial, what lawyers call pure economic loss. And this is one of the few tort corners where the law lets you recover it. Two flavors. Fraudulent misrepresentation, also called deceit, is the deliberate lie. The defendant knew the statement was false, or did not care whether it was true. Negligent misrepresentation is the careless statement, from someone sloppy with information they were in the business of supplying. Fraud is more serious, easier to sue on, and harder to prove. Fraud in one breath. A false statement of fact, made with a guilty mind, meant to get the listener to act, that the listener justifiably relies on, causing financial loss. Courts break that into six elements, and the claim fails the moment anyone is missing. So line them up like a checklist. Element 1. A false representation. The usual case is a spoken or written lie. The roof is brand new. But conduct counts too. Painting over water damage or turning back an odometer is active concealment. You are asserting a falsehood with your hands instead of your mouth, and the law treats it exactly like a spoken lie. The hard question is pure silence. The traditional starting point is caveat emptor. Let the buyer beware. So simply staying quiet is usually not a misrepresentation. You are generally not required to volunteer every bad fact about what you are selling, but that rule has grown large exceptions. Silence becomes actionable non-disclosure when a duty to disclose exists. Five situations. A fiduciary or relationship of trust. A half-truth, where once you volunteer part of the story, you must tell the rest. A statement true when made that has since become false. Active concealment, always actionable. And a known latent defect the buyer could not reasonably find. The half-truth is the one examiners love. A seller in Franklin tells a buyer, "This building passed its fire inspection." True. But the seller knows the inspector flagged the wiring for re-inspection in 30 days, and it has since failed. Accurate words, false overall impression. By speaking about the inspection at all, the seller took on a duty to complete the picture. Element 2. A material fact. Material means a reasonable person would attach importance to it in deciding what to do, or the defendant knew this plaintiff would. Trivial fibs that would move no rational buyer are not material. But the recurring trap is the other word, fact. Four things look like statements of fact and are not treated as facts: opinions, predictions, puffery, and statements of law. As a default, none is actionable, and each has an exception examiners love. Opinion first. This is a great investment, is a judgment, and listeners know it. But an opinion becomes actionable in three cases: when the speaker has superior knowledge or claims special expertise, when a fiduciary gives it, or when the opinion implies undisclosed facts that would justify it. Prediction next. No one guarantees tomorrow, so a promise about the future is not actionable, unless the promise was made with a present intent not to keep it. That is promissory fraud, and it works because your present mental state is itself a fact. A developer in Colombia promises to build a park while privately intending never to build it. Not a prediction. A lie about what the developer intends right now. Puffery, third. Finest coffee in town is vague boasting nobody takes literally. Fact or puffery? Puffery. Now try certified organic. Or 12,000 miles. Fact or puffery? Fact. Specific and verifiable is the line. And statements of law. Traditionally opinion because both sides can read the law. The modern view makes one actionable if it implies facts, or if the speaker has superior legal knowledge the listener reasonably trusts. Element 3. Scienter, the guilty mind. This is the heart of fraud, and the single line separating it from negligent misrepresentation. It is not enough that the statement was false. The defendant must have had a culpable state of mind about its falsity. Three mental states qualify: knowing it was false, having no belief that it was true, meaning no idea and asserting it anyway, or recklessly, with conscious indifference to whether it was true or false. Notice the last two do not require knowing the statement was false. Back to the car. A dealer in Olympia tells a buyer this car has never been wrecked. If the dealer pulled the history report, saw the crash, and said it anyway, that is knowing falsity, full fraud. If the dealer had no idea and invented the reassurance to close the sale, that is asserting a fact with no belief in its truth. Still fraud. But if the dealer honestly, though carelessly, relied on a sloppy prior owner's word and repeated it in good faith, there is no scienter, so no fraud. Honest carelessness is not scienter. That is the territory of negligent misrepresentation. Element 4. Intent to induce reliance. The defendant must have intended the statement to get someone to act. This element also fixes who may sue. In fraud, the class is generous, reaching anyone the defendant intended to reach, and anyone in a class they had reason to expect would learn of and rely on it, in the kind of transaction they had in mind. So a false financial statement handed over to show the banks can be relied on by any bank in the lending group, even ones the defendant never met. Hold that generosity in mind. Negligent misrepresentation slams this door nearly shut, and we will come to it. Element 5. Justifiable reliance. The plaintiff must actually rely, meaning the statement was a real factor in the decision, and must do so justifiably. Reliance is not justifiable if the plaintiff already knew the truth, or the falsity was obvious, or the claim was absurd. And here is the counterintuitive part, the one from the top of the episode. A fraud victim generally has no duty to investigate. You are entitled to take an affirmative factual assertion at face value. That a little digging would have exposed the lie does not excuse the liar. One caution. Do not confuse justifiable reliance with the fact versus opinion line. Reliance on a pure opinion is usually not justifiable, which is why opinions are not actionable. But once you are inside an opinion exception, reliance becomes justifiable again. Work the fact question first, then ask whether reliance was reasonable. Element 6. Causation and damages. Reliance must actually cause pecuniary loss, of the kind that foreseeably flows from the misrepresentation. No out-of-pocket harm, no fraud claim. Unlike some torts, there are no nominal damages for deceit. Then the measure. And this is where fraud is at its most plaintiff-friendly. Two of them. Benefit of the bargain gives the difference between the value as represented and the actual value received. Out of pocket gives the difference between what you paid and what you actually got. Made whole, not enriched. Make it concrete. A buyer pays $30,000 for a car the seller fraudulently represents, and it is actually worth $20,000. Out of pocket is $10,000. Now suppose the represented features would have made it worth $35,000. Benefit of the bargain is $15,000, the represented figure minus the actual value. Fraud plaintiffs in most states get the larger number. Benefit of the bargain is the majority rule for fraud in a commercial deal. Out of pocket is the minority rule, and the only measure for negligent and innocent misrepresentation. Add consequential losses, and because fraud involves a guilty mind, punitive damages are on the table. Now the second flavor. Sometimes the defendant did not lie. They were simply careless with information other people were counting on. An accountant certifies financial statements without checking the numbers. A surveyor maps the wrong boundary. A title company misreads the records. No guilty mind, so fraud fails. Negligent misrepresentation fills that gap, but the law is nervous about it. Careless words can ripple out to countless readers and produce ruinous, open-ended liability. So the tort is boxed in on three sides. Who can be a defendant, who can sue, and how much they recover? The elements come from Section 552. The defendant supplied false information in the course of a business, profession, or employment, or in a transaction in which they had a financial interest. A casual friend giving free advice generally is not liable. The information was supplied for the guidance of others in their business transactions. Then the defendant failed to use reasonable care in obtaining or communicating that information. That is, the negligence, sloppiness rather than a lie. The plaintiff justifiably relied, and the reliance caused pecuniary loss. Now the single most tested point in this tort, so make it reflex. Unlike fraud, you cannot sue just because it was foreseeable someone might rely. Recovery is limited to the specific person or the limited group the defendant knew would receive and rely on the information for the transaction the defendant had in mind. That is a deliberate middle ground, broader than old strict privity, which let only the defendant's direct client sue, far narrower than pure foreseeability, which would expose the defendant to the world. See it work. An accountant in Franklin negligently audits Acme Corporation and certifies inflated financials. Acme gives the report to First Bank of Franklin to get a specific loan, and the accountant knows this. First Bank lends and loses money. Can First Bank sue? Yes. It is exactly the user and transaction the accountant had in mind. Damages are strictly out of pocket. The plaintiff recovers the actual loss caused by relying on the bad information, not the benefit of the bargain they hoped for, and no punitive damages because there was no evil intent to punish. Another reason plaintiffs prefer fraud when the facts support scienter. One boundary worth marking. Section 552 covers pure money loss. If a negligent misstatement instead threatens physical injury, courts use ordinary negligence rules, and the class who can sue is the broader foreseeability class. Spot which kind of harm the facts involve first. Put the two side by side, because that comparison is what the exam rewards. State of mind, scienter, against carelessness. Who can be a defendant? Anyone against a business or professional supplier. Who can sue? Broad against the known limited group. Damages. Benefit of the bargain against out of pocket. Punitive damages. Available against never. And one more line on that chart. Comparative fault. The plaintiff's own carelessness reduces recovery in negligent misrepresentation. It is no defense at all to fraud. A deliberate liar cannot shrink their liability by pointing at the victim for believing them. A narrow third tort also exists: innocent misrepresentation. In a sale, rental, or exchange the defendant is party to, a material misstatement of fact made to induce the deal can create liability with no scienter and no negligence. Strict liability, capped at out-of-pocket damages. Finally, the defenses, and most simply attack a missing element. Truth, a complete defense. It was only opinion, puffery, or prediction. No scienter, which defeats fraud outright. No justifiable reliance because the plaintiff knew the truth or relied on their own independent investigation. No causation or no pecuniary loss. Comparative fault, for the negligent variety only. And the statute of limitations, though a discovery rule often delays the clock, and fraudulent concealment tolls it while the wrong stays hidden. Then the one sellers reach for, the as-is clause, and the merger clause reciting that the buyer relies on no representations outside the contract. Watch this closely. You cannot contract your way out of your own fraud, and a general disclaimer will not defeat a deceit claim for a deliberate lie. Those clauses have more bite against negligent misrepresentation, and a specific disclaimer of a specific fact can sometimes make later reliance unjustifiable. But boilerplate does not launder actual fraud. A word on authorities, because this episode named no cases, and that was deliberate. The law here lives in restatement sections, and the exam tests application, not citation. This topic is also unstarred, which means the exam may hand you the governing rule inside a set of legal resources and ask you to apply it to the facts. If you keep only three, keep these. The fraud standard in Section 525, because it sets the six-element checklist. The scienter definition in Section 526, because scienter is the fork the whole topic turns on. And the narrow plaintiff class in Section 552, because it decides most negligent misrepresentation questions. Now the traps, gathered in one place. 1. Treating every false statement as fraud. No scienter, no fraud. Pivot to negligent misrepresentation, then check its far narrower requirements. 2. Forgetting that negligent misrepresentation has a tiny class of plaintiffs. Foreseeability is enough for fraud, never for the careless information tort. 3. Imposing a duty to investigate on a fraud victim. There generally is none, and a liar cannot hide behind the victim's failure to double-check. 4. Applying comparative fault to intentional fraud. It belongs only to the negligent variety. 5. Confusing the damage measures. Benefit of the bargain for fraud, out of pocket for negligent and innocent. 6. Assuming silence is safe. Half-truths, later falsified statements, fiduciary duties, and hidden latent defects all turn silence into actionable non-disclosure. And one piece of exam craft. Nail the state of mind fork and the who can sue point, and you will handle almost every misrepresentation question the exam throws at you. Time for the quick check, straight from the Bargo question bank. An accountant negligently certifies a company's inflated financial statements. The accountant is aware only that the company means to use them to seek bank financing. 2 years later, an individual investor finds those statements in a public filing. The investor relies on them in buying the stock and loses money when the inflated figures come to light. The accountant never knew of this investor or of any anticipated stock purchase. The investor sues for negligent misrepresentation. Can they recover? Option 1. No, because the accountant neither knew of this investor nor of a stock transaction. Option 2. Yes, because it was foreseeable that investors might eventually rely on the statements. Option 3. Yes, because the accountant negligently certified statements that should have been caught? Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 1. Recovery is limited to the known user and the transaction the supplier had in mind, or a substantially similar one. The accountant contemplated bank financing, not a stranger's later stock purchase, and knew nothing of this investor. So the investor sits outside the protected class. Option 2 applies pure foreseeability, which is the fraud standard, not the narrow negligence class. Foreseeable reliance is not enough. Option 3 restates the careless certification, but ignores that even a negligent misstatement yields no liability to a plaintiff outside the protected class. There are 30 plus more questions on this topic alone. 5 things to take away. 1. Fraud has 6 elements and dies if anyone is missing. False representation, material fact, scienter, intent to induce reliance, justifiable reliance, and pecuniary loss. 2. Scienter is the fork. Knowing falsity, no belief in truth, or recklessness. Honest carelessness is not scienter. 3. Silence is usually safe until a duty to disclose arises, and half-truths, stale statements, fiduciary relationships, and hidden latent defects all create one. 4. A fraud victim has no duty to investigate, and comparative fault is no defense to fraud. 5. Negligent misrepresentation is easier to prove and far harder to win. Only the known user and the contemplated transaction may sue, and damages stop at out-of-pocket, which is why the dealer who said the truck was never in an accident cannot escape by asking why you never pulled the report. Next time, defamation and privacy. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.